Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal 67th podcast. This week I'm talking to Chris Marden, C.F. Marden IV, the CEO and chairman of Marden Guitars out of Nazareth, Pennsylvania. And we're going to go deep. We're going to be talking about his, let's get this right, great-great-great-grandfather's original Marden guitars, as well as some of his grandparents' guitars. And this is all around this new book called Inventing the American Guitar, a beautiful coffee table book that has just come out, edited or co-edited by Peter Zago, who's done some work for the Fretboard Journal in the past. And I know normally talking about Romantic era, pre-Civil War guitars is not the most interesting thing necessarily, but this book is just absolutely beautiful, information-packed. And if you are into steel string acoustic guitars, if you're into classical guitars, if you're into anything really acoustic, you'll want to check this book out. It really sets a new standard for how guitar books should be. And we also talk a little bit about a new book on Marden ukuleles. So if you are a reading enthusiast and you like your Marden guitars or Marden ukuleles, you have a lot of holiday reading you can dive into this year. So we're going to be talking to Chris in just a minute. Fretboard Journal 30 is out. Fretboard Journal 31 is just around the corner. We're encouraging folks to subscribe at fretboardjournal.com, and you can start with either issue and see what all the fuss is about. This is a very cool reader-supported magazine that does a lot more than just put out these podcasts, so we hope you'll check that out. Without further ado, here is Chris Marden. So Chris Marden IV is on the line with us, and Chris, obviously, as any Marden fanatic knows, you guys were founded in 1833. It says so right there on the guitar. So you're celebrating 180 years, and the reason I want to talk to you is, you know, you guys seem to be doing a lot this year and next year in particular. And one of the things that was interesting as a guitar fanatic and collector is this new book edited by Robert Sean Peter Zago, Inventing the American Guitar. And this, a lot's been written about Marden over the last 10 years, but this gets really, really deep into some of the earliest Marden guitar creations from the 1800s. And I'm just kind of curious to you were born into this family. You've been living and breathing Marden guitars for a while. How familiar were you with these guitars in particular growing up, and how did you sort of get exposed to these earliest creations?
Well, unfortunately, my parents were divorced when I was three. So I didn't grow up in the family business. And I would come back and hang out for a week or two in the summer. And it wasn't until later in high school and in early college that I took an interest in the family business and then realized how much I didn't know. And at that point, it was more about learning about the overall history and the focus on quality and taking care of my coworkers. The first real exposure I got to some of CF's early work, other than the few instruments that we had here, one was in my grandfather's den that I would go and hang out. Scott Chinnery had a bunch of them. And Scott, you know, may he rest in peace, was very generous with his collection. And I remember going to his house several times, and in his den he had the prizes of his collection behind glass cases. And I was there and standing at the glass case looking, and he said, "Well, aren't you going to, like, pick them up?" And I'm like, "I would love to." He said, "Well, go, of course, you know." So I got to look, you know, really closely at some what are called Stauffer Marden guitars. But I didn't connect the dots the way that the book has. And then I've encountered those guitars in my travels. I'd see one. I'd go into a music store to do a clinic, and someone would say, "Hey, you know, we have this, a customer brought this in. He wanted you to see it, or it's part of the owner's collection." And I have to tell you, I'm about halfway through the book. I just got my copy last week. It's intense.
It's deep.
You know, it's a very scholarly work.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, okay, I'm going to talk to you today. I should at least try and read some of it. So over the weekend and last week, I got halfway through and I said, okay, I have a better understanding of the points they're trying to make. And there's many points that they're trying to make in the book, which I'd be glad to talk about if you want me to keep talking.
Keep talking. Yeah. I mean, for people who haven't seen this thing yet, and most people probably haven't, you know, there's bracing patterns. I mean, this gets really intense, but for the small group of people who, you know, love and are
you know, studying these guitars like crazy. It's really groundbreaking. I guess the one thing I'd love for you to talk about is sort of the Martin guitars are kind of a melting pot of German culture, the Stauffer Vienna stuff, and then Spanish guitars.
Yeah. And, you know, now that it's been written, you would go, well, of course. But you almost needed someone or a group of people to sit down and say, we're trying to make a point here, and it's going to take a book to do it. The first thing that surprised me was the size of the book. I didn't expect something, you know, it's a coffee table book.
Yeah.
It's big, the pictures, the photography is beautiful. And then the way the different authors, you know, they each have a chapter that they wrote or an essay to try and make their point, and they build upon each other. CF grew up with his father in Markneukirchen. It appears that the book says that even his father took a keen interest in the guitar. The guitar, of course, you know, worked its way up out of the Mediterranean. And by the time it got to Northern Europe, Central Europe, in the late 17, early 1800s, it had come into its own more or less. You know, there was a lot of experimentation. And so they talk about in Markneukirchen, the violin makers really didn't, they were dismissive of the guitar. It's like, oh, you know, it's kind of a folk instrument. It's not really a classic instrument like the violin, so don't bother. And then CF, with the help of his father, and without the help of the violin makers, ultimately moved to Vienna and worked there and learned how to make Stauffer-style guitars. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I've taken away from those guitars, and they don't touch on it in the book, is that those guitars were extremely delicate. Mm-hmm. Really delicate. And you could, okay, so you're a customer in Europe, you go to a music store, you buy your Stauffer-style guitar, you take it home, and that may be where it stays. Mm-hmm. In America, it's very possible you would buy a guitar, and it would go with you wherever it is you were going. You know, whether you were just traveling for leisure or for work, or you were moving your entire family, that you emigrated from Europe and you're headed west in a Conestoga wagon. And I don't think those Stauffer guitars could survive the trip.
Sure.
So CF, apparently in New York, and then even after he moved to Pennsylvania, he would go back to New York. He was exposed to and also encouraged by people that he dealt with, people who helped him sell the guitars, to take a closer look at these guitars that were coming to America that were being made in Spain. And the more he looked at them, the more he said, this is a better mousetrap.
Yeah. What, obviously, you mentioned some of the contributors to this book, and many of them have written for the Fretboard Journal, but what can you talk a little bit about the role of the Martin Archives and sort of what you as a company did to, or what you continue to do to kind of open up what you guys have to these researchers?
Well, we're fortunate. Someone, I forget who, told me, because they have more experience with this, that we have the best records. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, well, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the company's never been sold, and we only moved once. Now, you think about Gibson and Fender,
sure.
And the companies themselves have moved several times, and the ownership has changed. And I think, unfortunately, every time there was a new owner, they would say, hey, get rid of those old papers there. Who needs those old? We don't need those old papers anymore. There's just boxes of old paper. And with us, you know, we kept our old papers. There is a gap, it's pointed out in the book, of about 10 years, and that's unfortunate. It again, in the moving and all, where there are very few records, so the only records are the instruments themselves. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, we have a lot of paper documentation. The only thing that we don't have, and it's probably because it didn't exist, is we don't have a narrative from that point in time. We don't have any interviews with CF. We don't have any diaries. Mm-hmm. So what we have to do is we have to look at invoices and correspondence and the instruments themselves and say, okay, based on all this information that is available, and we you know, Dick Boak, when he talked to me about this project, I had no idea what he was talking about, first of all. But I said, sure. You know, you want to bring some folks you know in, and I remember they would come and hang out in the museum, and they'd have tables, and they'd have all the guitars and lights and, you know, mirrors, and they're looking through all the archival paperwork. And, of course, you know, I'm so glad I gave him that permission, because it really is a wonderful work. And it's going to cause some controversy. Yeah. There are going to be people that disagree with bits and pieces of it. But it's... you know, it isn't just saying that it was only CF. There were other people, other American builders that were involved with him or competed with him that were also aware of the fact that this Spanish design, first of all, I think it was more durable and it made a better sound. Mm-hmm. That initially they went from these, you know, weird transverse braces on the top, which I think do nothing for the sound, to the fan bracing. And then in the book they talk about how CF embraced the Spanish fan bracing. But when he went to the pin bridge, and again, speculation, they said it was probably very difficult for him to align everything to guarantee that when he drilled the holes in the bridge for the bridge pins that he would never drill through a fan brace. Mm-hmm. And they think that is the reason, from a very practical standpoint, that he began to develop what we call today Martin X bracing.
Interesting. Yeah, there are so many facts in this book. It's so dense. I encourage folks.
The Spanish heel.
Yeah.
You know, to go away from that ice cream cone heel, which is very elegant but very delicate, to the Spanish heel, and then moving away from that. And if I'm sure you've seen them, where the Spanish builders start out with a larger neck. And the top block is actually part of the neck.
Yeah.
And they cut a couple of slots in that chunk of wood and build the sides of the guitar into the neck. So from that point on, you're working with this very unwieldy thing.
Yeah.
You know, that's got the neck attached to the body. And I think CF was like, oh, that's crazy. That's just crazy. And so he came up with the dovetail. The funniest thing was, part of that Spanish heel was this little thing they called the foot, which extended down from the top block down the back for a couple of inches, mm-hmm. and added reinforcement and kept the neck from rotating under pressure. And in the book, they talk about how CF, you know, and God bless them. I mean, this is long before there were patents and trademarks and all that. You could shamelessly copy mm-hmm. someone else. So it said in the book that he would put these little feet in, but they were fake. They just gave you the impression, and then he eventually said, well, why am I doing that?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to take that thing out. So I think that it's funny that he had this kind of sense of humor about, if that's what the customer wants,
yeah,
that's what I will give them, even though it doesn't serve a purpose.
Yeah. Well, can you also talk, I mean, this book is amazing, and then you also have something really special going on at the Met next year. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I think once we, and I, you know, have to thank everyone involved in the book, convinced the Met that the book itself was going to be a scholarly work. It wasn't going to be a novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was going to be fact-based, that they warmed up to, okay, we should acknowledge this theory because C.F. Martin's original location was in Manhattan. And it's, you know, it's tough to get the Met to commit to something like that. They have these long lead times.
Sure.
They have a vetting process where they don't want to find out after the fact that they got, you know, talked into something that wasn't right or wasn't true. But they and if it helped to have Jason Dobney, who's working at the Met, participate in the book. They said, yeah, this is worth acknowledging. Mm-hmm. So next year, starting in January, for an entire year, upstairs where they have the musical instruments, which is a little bit obscure to find. You have to get the map out.
Mm-hmm.
But they're going to display instruments, Martin instruments, Spanish instruments, Stauffer instruments, instruments from Martin's contemporaries and competitors, and give a visitor a chance to actually see the instruments that were created that the book supports. And I think it's just going to be really a really cool thing for anyone who's into the guitar. You know, you may not get all the way through the book, but you can go to the Met and get a dose of the book visually just by seeing the guitars and reading the story that they'll produce for the display.
Yeah, and I think these guitars, I mean, what's so fascinating about them is you can see modern guitar in them. You can see the evolution, but they're really works of art. And I mean, they're incredible just to look at, even if you don't want to wade through.
Well, and I tell people, you know, again, you know, seeing the instruments in our collection, seeing the ones that Scott owned, and, you know, periodically encountering very, very early Martin guitars, I can't make a better guitar.
Yeah.
I can't. You know, I can make more of them, and I can make a worse guitar, but you look at and he didn't have CNC machines.
Yeah.
He didn't have climate control. This was, you know, CF's intent to make what I like, you know, people might laugh when I say this, but he tried to make the perfect guitar. Mm-hmm. And he got really close every time he made one.
Yeah. Yeah. This isn't the only book, actually, about Martin that just came out in the last, or is coming out this month. There's that book by Tom Walsh and John King on Martin ukulele history.
Oh, my God. Another. Unbelievable. And this was another one Dick Bulk would say, yeah, a couple of guys writing a book about ukuleles. And then he said, oh, and unfortunately, one passed away. And it's unbelievable. Yeah. You know, and I always knew that we had a significant place in the history of the ukulele. Mm-hmm. But this really, really acknowledges that, you know, Martin, of all of the ukulele builders, has been there and stayed there more consistently than anyone else. And the oddest thing is it's a very fickle market.
Yeah.
Now, this is the third ukulele boom my family's business has experienced in our 180 years. So you can't really run a business for 180 years just on three booms.
Yeah.
But we've been able to capitalize on it. And people have respected the fact that, okay, if I want a really, really good ukulele, mm-hmm. I should consider a Martin.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with the fact that people start out with inexpensive imported ukuleles. You're not going to go out and buy a $1,000 ukulele if you're not sure.
Sure.
But if enough people go, hey, this is fun, I'm committed, I want to get a better ukulele, we're ready.
Yeah.
How long the current boom's going to last, I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, and we'll put the fixturing aside, and if and when it, you know, resurrects its head again, we'll be ready.
So we've talked a lot in the last few minutes about Martin's past. What are you most excited about going forward?
What excites me is the ongoing durability of the acoustic guitar. Uh-huh. I'm a bit in awe of the fact that after all this time, here's this instrument that, like I said, you know, was kind of modernized in the late 1700s. And then my family modernized it again in the 1840s. Mm-hmm. And then modernized it again in the 1930s. And it's more popular around the world than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. You know, I travel quite a bit. And I get the biggest kick out of getting off a plane in Bangkok and seeing some 18-year-old Thai kid waiting at the, you know, walking off the plane or walking through the airport with what I know is, if it isn't a Martin guitar in that guitar case, it's a copy of a Martin guitar in that guitar case. And I'm like, that's cool. That's cool that thing that my family's been doing for all this time gets that kid in Thailand excited enough that he's taking that thing with him wherever he's going.
Nice. Chris, thank you so much for talking. I know you've got a busy day.
Sure.
But, yeah, thanks so much.
And like I said, the book's coming out any day. I got an advanced copy. And the exhibit at the Met is all next year. Go to the Met, get the map, go upstairs on the second floor, go down a hallway, open a door, and you'll be amazed.
Okay? Sounds good. Have a great day.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.